And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The city of Louisville is one of the nation's top focuses during the current protests against the deaths of African Americans at the hands of police. And meanwhile, there is an election in the Commonwealth in just 18 days as Democrats, who want to take on Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, are trying to connect with voters amid these protests and also the COVID-19 pandemic. So joining us now to talk about it, our Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Ryland, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Michael.
And we also have with us on the phone line Lexington Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers. Daniel, thank you for being back with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
513-419-7110 is our number if you want to join us as well. Ryland, I want to start with you. Take us to Louisville. I mean, we're certainly seeing things here in Cincinnati, and we've been talking about them all week. We'll talk about them more coming up later in this news review. But Louisville has been the center of people's attention all over the country. What is the state of things currently in Louisville, and what should we expect this weekend?
Well, there have been massive protests with thousands of people every day, for the last 8 days now. But really, for the last three or four, since Monday night, things have been pretty peaceful here. The protests have been peaceful, but I think that really a lot of that is because the police have been peaceful as well. The first few days are marked with police showing up in riot gear and, trying to break up crowds with tear gas and pepper balls and just kind of, pretty indiscriminately shooting at crowds with these pepper balls. Amid a lot of frustration, and then in an instance in which Louisville police shot and killed David McAtee, a beloved business owner in West Louisville, at a gathering on Sunday night, things have really tapered since then. People are still very angry, but things have been peaceful. Police have still been showing up to these protests, but not as in large numbers, and they haven't been trying to break them up. The mayor had instituted this curfew over the weekend and had been breaking up these protests under the auspices of people violating that curfew. They started ignoring that. The police even, stopped, recognizing that they're going to try to disperse crowds violating the curfew, and then the mayor totally disbanded it. But the mayor here, and I think, there's a lot of people who are still demanding a lot of questions to be answered and apologies to be made.
Take us to some of the scenes earlier in these protests, because I know you got caught up along with some other reporters. I've seen plenty of social media posts about some of these pepper balls and some of the what you called indiscriminate shooting from the police to break these up.
Right. And especially, the police's and the mayor's, the city's initial line was that, people who are protesting peacefully aren't going to be attacked, aren't going to be dispersed. Of course, that changed once the curfew was put in place. But, it was really just anybody who was out on the streets was going to be, pepperballed or tear gassed with no warning. And there are many, many accounts of that. And sure, reporters got caught up in this, but, reporters have, we are just like anybody else out there. Yes, everybody, just about everybody has been, who is out on the streets at night. Over the past week, or at least those first few days, got a taste of tear gas and pepper ball.
Ryland, what can you tell us about the state of the Breonna Taylor case? I understand that the officers involved are still being investigated.
Right. This goes all the way back to March 13th. This is when a no-knock warrant was issued for the address where Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old emergency room technician, lived. Police kicked in the door, and her boyfriend shot, not knowing who that was, at least according to his account, and they started shooting, and they ended up shooting Taylor 8 times. There's an ongoing investigation. The officers involved have been put on administrative leave, and basically LMPD has been, their public integrity unit's been conducting an internal investigation, and then they've asked the state attorney general to review the case. The attorney general says he hasn't gotten everything from the city yet. He says it should be coming in soon. So that's kind of where it stands right now. Meanwhile, there's been lots of calls for the mayor to just outright fire the officers involved in this. He says that he can't do that because of due process reasons, both state law and also the collective bargaining agreement with the city police's union. And so people are angry about that. And we're kind of waiting to see what happens. And, the next step, again, is kind of for the everything to go to the Attorney General and for the Attorney General to begin his investigation.
And then, Ryland, in the midst of all this, as you noted, a restaurant owner, David McAtee, was also killed by law enforcement. And while apparently there is video of those moments out there, this video did not come from police body cams. So we've learned that the police did not have their cameras on?
Right. So that Sunday night, after police had cleared out downtown, they went out to West Louisville, the intersection of 26 and Broadway, where there were some people gathered there. They're going to disperse that gathering. In the end, David McAtee was shot. In the morning after, we learned that there was no body cam footage of this, even though those police should have had body cameras on and recording. Mayor Fisher immediately fired Louisville Chief of Police Steve Conrad. He was already on his way out. He was set to retire in a month. So the police ended up releasing security camera footage from around McAtee's business. He was a barbecue shop owner in West Louisville. And really, the video did only raise more questions about what happened. Police said this indicates that McAtee shot at police officers and that they were just returning fire. This, mind you, is also the first instance in which Louisville police used live, or the National Guard used live ammunition in responding to gatherings or protests going on in Louisville over those days. And what the video shows is, some people gathered at David McAtee's business, police showing up and starting to shoot pepper ball at them, people fleeing inside. And there's a moment in which David McAtee steps out. This is where police say that he shoots back at police, and in which they open fire, shooting several bullets at his business, one of which strikes him and kills him. This has been analyzed. The New York Times just released an analysis kind of combining several videos at the same time, giving a rendition of it this morning. It's worth a read. But it's a very confusing thing, and all of this would have been a lot clearer if there were body camera footage.
And Ryland, what has this done? I mean, for this to happen in the midst of this unrest already, these protests against killings at the hands of police, what has this done to the mood there? You note that the protests aren't as, I guess, dangerous or as violent as they had been early on, but what has this done to people's mood and feelings about what's happening in Louisville?
I mean, that moment really just angered everybody. It was, this is the very thing that people are out in the streets protesting against, and here it happens. Another black man shot by police, shot and killed by police. I think that this is a moment where, it seems like the city, the city government realized that something wrong happened here, and they've really tried to pull back and be more peaceful. And I think what a lot of people are focused on is just the kind of proportionality of it all. Do you need police in military riot gear responding to groups of protesters? Is there a way to just, if the problem is people looting or causing destruction to private property, isn't there a way to just go after those people instead of, other people who are peacefully protesting? So there's still a lot of problems and issues that people have and are raising with the city, and they want them to respond to. But to the city's credit, over the last few days, it's been peaceful. And I'm sure, Lexington has done a great job of that, as well as I'm sure Dan DeRocher can account or whatever. They've been, trying to not show up in riot gear. I know at least yesterday the headline was that in Lexington there, police who showed up just in a plain clothes or in regular uniforms instead of in riot gear.
And that's Ryland Barton from Kentucky Public Radio. Let's bring in Daniel DeRochers from the Lexington Herald Leader. How have these played out in Lexington, Daniel?
So the Lexington protests have been pretty peaceful. The police officers have not used any tear gas, have not used any rubber bullets, anything like what we've seen in Louisville. And they've been going on for 5 days. So Louisville started Thursday, protests in Lexington, or my day count might be off, it's been busy, and the Lexington protests started Friday. And so, yeah, you know, the first night, the police officers were not wearing any riot gear. And it was kind of interesting because the protesters went right up to them and were yelling, screaming in the faces of the police officers, and they just kind of stood there. And then, you know, it moved on. The next night they showed up and they did have riot gear. But last night they put up a barricade around the police department. And so the officers were plainclothes with kind of this fence that was surrounding them, which they said was for safety. And so it's been pretty stark in the difference in response between Lexington and Louisville. And I think there are a lot of factors there. I mean, obviously Lexington's smaller, but I think that it's also, you know, the actual shootings that happened in Louisville make the dynamic really different in Louisville than they are, than it is in Lexington.
Daniel, I know you're at all the briefings that Governor Andy Beshear is holding, whether it's to update on the coronavirus or to address the situations as they unfold in Kentucky, particularly in Louisville. What has the governor had to say about the unrest that's happening in the Commonwealth?
It's been pretty interesting to watch his response. I mean, he's kind of going from the political playbook on how to respond to this. You know, he's been saying that he's listening, that he he can't ever truly understand the pain that Black Kentuckians go through because, you know, he's white. And so he's been saying those types of things. He's also been demanding kind of transparency and accountability. It was really interesting on Monday. He kind of came out in the morning and said, we are going to release the body cam footage. And then by 4 o'clock, he said, well, they don't have the body cam footage, so they won't be releasing it. And he seemed pretty kind of angry about that, right? Like, he seemed, you know, when I asked him about how, you know, whether or not the officer should be held accountable, he was really mad that they weren't wearing body cameras, and, you know, in kind of his tempered way. And so I think he's been doing a lot of trying to smooth over a very difficult situation. And, you know, it's kind of a difficult task for any politician right now. I don't think it's really easy when people are in the streets demanding change from a system that changes very, very slowly.
And we're talking with Daniel DeRochers of the Lexington Herald Leader, and we're also joined by Rylan Barton of Kentucky Public Radio. Daniel, at the briefing that Governor Beshear held on Thursday, the issue of the Jefferson Davis statue at the state capitol came up. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy during the Civil War, also a native of Kentucky. There's a statue of him in the Capitol Rotunda. He says that it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, and this is actually not a change in position for him. He has said this before. He said it on the campaign trail in 2019. So really, the decision on whether or not the Jefferson Davis statue is in the Capitol is up to the Historic Properties Commission in Frankfort. And my colleague Jack Brammer's actually been covering this for a really long time because there's been a push to get rid of it since 2015. And so, you know, over and over again, people have said, hey, this really shouldn't be in the Capitol, because originally there was a plaque on it that said Patriot Hero Statesman. So when I first started covering Kentucky, that was one of the first things that I noticed, that there was a statue of Jefferson Davis in the Capitol that said that he was a patriot. You know, that was interesting. And so in 2018, the Historic Properties Commission, they took the step of removing that plaque, but they have not removed the statue. And so, you know, now there's obviously going to be more pressure on them to remove the statue. Attorney General Daniel Cameron has now also said that he thinks that that statue shouldn't be in the Capitol. And so, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But this group has been very, very slow in making any kind of decision to, you know, it took them 3 years before they removed the plaque. You have to imagine that they'll be slow in deliberating on whether or not to remove the statue as well.
Ryland, there is, amid all of this, amid the protests that are taking place in Kentucky's largest cities and the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, there's also an election. It was supposed to take place in May, but due to the pandemic, was pushed back to June 23rd. This is the primary election in Kentucky. There are three Democrats who want to go up against Senator Mitch McConnell in the fall. How are their campaigns working out right now with all of this other stuff either displacing the public campaign or interrupting it in the news cycle?
Well, I think that the, you know, one of the big stories out of this is, you know, how this has launched, you know, Louisville State Representative Charles Booker's campaign even to more prominence, especially in Louisville. You know, he as one of the lesser known candidates. Of course, many people have heard of Amy McGrath, who's raised a whole lot of money to run against what will likely be Mitch McConnell. But you know, Charles Booker is a first term state representative, and he's a black man from West Louisville. And he is he has been everywhere, especially in the early days of this protest, to not only to provide a voice to the frustration and the injustice going on, but also I would say that he's been helping to try and broker a peace. He's been he appeared with Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher at one point, and after the shooting of David McAtee. And I think that this is, this is a time where, he's been getting his name out there, but also he's been saying a lot of very important things, and a lot of people have been listening. This has been, a time in which there's a whole lot of people who are, wanting a change. And, when it comes down to it, the main way in which change is going to happen is at the ballot box. And I think he's been really getting his message out there. Of course, there's two other main candidates in this race, Mike Breuer and Amy McGrath. They haven't, they haven't really shown up to the protest. Breuer on Monday during the KET debate said he didn't want to do it because, he didn't want to try to, appear as a political opportunist, but he has, voiced support for the folks who are out protesting. Amy McGrath said she didn't want to because of the, ongoing coronavirus pandemic, which is frankly another giant issue with all these protests. And so, yeah, it's been interesting how this has shaped the campaign. There's been a lot of questions whether, there is as much support for Amy McGrath as, as there was at one point. We certainly don't have much polling about this, and it's all very confusing. But I think that this, these have only, I think that the protests have only kind of probably further chipped away at, at Amy McGrath's support, or really just more, probably giving Charles Booker a bit of a boost.
Daniel, in our last minute together, these three candidates, Amy McGrath, Mike Breuer, and Charles Booker, appeared in a debate this week hosted by Kentucky Education Television, KET. Did anybody appear to emerge with momentum out of that?
I mean, I think it's what Rylan said, right? This is a moment in which Charles Booker is certainly getting the earned media that he's been looking for his whole campaign. He got into the race in January when McGrath had gotten into the race in July. And so he's been trying to make up ground ever since. And it's been, frankly, it has appeared to be an uphill battle for him. The big question is, will it be enough? I mean, people have already started voting in a lot of the state, right? Because you can already request your absentee ballot. And so, if there is an injection of money that comes with his, increased appearances, if there is an increase in support, is it too little, too late? That, I think, is the big question kind of heading into the next couple of weeks.
Daniel DeRochers is a reporter with the Lexington Herald Leader, and Rylan Barton is with Kentucky Public Radio. Thanks to both of you for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And just a programming note, on Cincinnati Edition next Tuesday, June 9th, we will have a preview of Kentucky's congressional race, Northern Kentucky's congressional race, the 4th Congressional District, featuring incumbent Republican Thomas Massey and his Republican opponent in the primary, and both Democrats seeking that office. On Wednesday, June 10th, we will talk to all three candidates running for U.S. Senate on the Democratic side, Amy McGrath, Charles Booker, and Mike Breuer. They are all looking for a chance to go up against Mitch McConnell in the fall. And the weekly news review will continue. One downtown Cincinnati protest was briefly interrupted when a car nearly ran through the crowd. And a landlord's lawsuit to reopen Hamilton County eviction courts appears to have been successful. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our weekly news review now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporters Dan Horn. Dan, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Scott Wortman. Scott, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Scott, I want to start with you because there was a pretty scary scene near the city building this week when a black BMW from Kentucky apparently nearly ran into the crowd. Can you take us to that moment? You were there.
Yeah, I was walking out of the city council meeting. P.G. Sittenfeld was walking out with me. And there was a protest going on, peaceful. People were just standing on Plum Street. They were in a line on the crosswalk at the intersection with Plum and 9th Street. And I was turned away for a moment, and all of a sudden I hear these brakes screeching and this thud, and I look over and there is a car, a black BMW, in the crowd. People are screaming. The car moves forward again. Then people start slamming on the hood, and then the car backs up and then speeds off east on 9th Street. I tried to get photos of it, but I was not prepared for something like that. And it was utter chaos.
And Scott, I imagine that this. I was just going to say this must have immediately triggered memories of what happened in Charlottesville a few years back with that deadly mm-hmm. crash.
Yes, luckily no one was hurt on this, and the investigation is ongoing. But now police are saying that it was unintentional. I don't know. There haven't been any details on why that is or why they think that. But so far, no police reports have been filed. So they said at this point they don't know what the police say they don't know what the next steps are.
And so police have not said what led to the determination for them to believe that this was likely not intentional?
Well, they said they were looking at the surveillance photo, and they just said that they don't believe it's intentional. They encourage people that were there that said they got hit to file a police report, and then they can take it from there. But as of yesterday, no police report has been filed, according to the Cincinnati police.
Okay, and Scott, we do want to talk about that city council meeting that you witnessed shortly before that car incident. But first, let's go over to your colleague, Dan Horn, who's also on the phone with us. Dan, there's been a lot of information coming out from protesters who were arrested earlier in the week and decried the conditions that they experienced while in the custody of the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. And the Sheriff's Office says that they took care of them. So what are we hearing on both sides here?
Well, the protesters who were actually in custody were pretty unhappy about it. They took to social media on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, posting videos of themselves locked in what is generally a sally port outside of the Justice Center, where typically deputies will come in or police officers will come in with suspects. It's a secure area. It's got high walls, barbed wire on top, and the main door can be locked. And it's typically used as a drop-off point. In this case, because they had so many people coming in over one night, I had been out the night before, I think it was Sunday night, and they had arrested well over 100 people, closer to 200 people that night. And they had to house them somewhere, and instead of putting them inside, they kept them in the sally port area and then processed them one after another. And people inside were complaining that there were no restroom facilities, they weren't taking them in to use the restroom, that some people had been sick and urinating outside. They'd not been provided any additional clothing or blankets because they had, they were arrested, some of them in shorts and T-shirts the night before. Temperatures dropped down to the 40s, so there were a lot of unhappy people in there. The sheriff says that, they were caring for them. They were providing them restroom breaks. They were trying to do their best to accommodate them. We don't know exactly because we weren't in there, but the videos coming out showed a very crowded area with a lot of young people, mostly pretty upset about the conditions they were in.
And Dan, this is coming, of course, during the coronavirus pandemic. Prior to these protests erupting across the country, including here in Cincinnati, we had all reported on the way that the jail was trying to lower the number of inmates that it was keeping in order to enhance its social distancing efforts. But I guess this probably overwhelmed that situation a bit.
Yeah, they told us they had room for them if judges were going to jail them after their hearings. That did not happen. Almost all of the ones arrested that night and all of the ones that were in that sally port area were there for curfew violations. They were not there for looting or violent interactions with police. They were pretty much cornered Sunday night after the tear gassing in front of the courthouse, and they were cornered in over the Rhine and taken away in buses. And almost all of them were there for curfew violations. So none of them were actually housed in the jail or kept beyond that one night. I think some of them, in hindsight, were wondering why they couldn't have been housed inside. I don't know the answer to that. The Sheriff's Department felt that was the most secure area for that number of people. But they were in close quarters. Some of them had masks, and many of the protesters have masks. But, when you're housed in one area, and if people are, using not using restroom facilities and urinating around you. It's not exactly a sanitary environment.
Dan, have we heard from city or county leaders on the concerns expressed by the inmates?
No. The sheriff said they did all they could do for them, and we've not really heard anything more than that on what happened that night. I know some public defenders were pretty unhappy about it, they moved quickly that morning to get them processed and get them out. There were a lot of folks on social media who were upset about it, but as far as I know at this point, there's been no formal complaint filed with the sheriff's department by anyone other than, you know, the folks who were there.
We're talking with Dan Horn and Scott Wortman of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Scott, take us to that city council meeting that was taking place before the car incident during that protest. And according to the reporting and the story that you offered with your colleague Hannah Sparling, Cincinnati City Council gave the police chief a standing ovation. So they seem to be pleased with the work that the department is doing.
Yeah, they all praised them. I mean, they did offer some light criticism and questioning on certain issues, such as P.G. Sittenfeld questioned him on whether he supported purchasing, you know, militarized weapons. The chief said no, he's against that, although then after he said that, then people started posting photos of tactical vehicles owned by the police. So it's, I guess it's kind of a matter of semantics on what's militarized and what isn't. But it was a very reflective, for the most of the council meeting, which lasted about two and a half hours, it was a very reflective, philosophical meeting where each council member took turns kind of discussing the last few days and what it meant to them. And some of the African-American members, particularly like Chris Smitherman, talked about advice there, you know, his father gave him, that he shouldn't hide his intelligence. So it got pretty emotional.
And Scott, there's another issue emerging at the local government level. You wrote about how Hamilton County is expected to vote soon declaring racism a public health crisis.
Yeah, Hamilton County is not the first government body to look at this. Columbus City Council did, I believe it was last week, they declared it a public health emergency. Democratic lawmakers in the General Assembly are looking at the same thing. But this was proposed by Victoria Parks. She is the commissioner that she was Todd Portoon's chief of staff and is now filling out the remainder of his term this year. And she said in the next month she's going to have a proposal together for the Hamilton County commissioners to declare racism a public health emergency. She cited not only the issues with black people dying at the hands of police, but also how the coronavirus has infected and impacted a disproportionate amount of people in the African-American community, and a variety of other factors that need to be addressed by local leadership. Exactly what it'll mean, she said that's going to be the work of the next month. She didn't want to just throw out a resolution that was just boilerplate or symbolic. She said she wanted, as she said, meat on the bones. And so we'll find out in the next month exactly what this resolution will do.
So we don't know whether it would open up funding opportunities for organizations or studies or civil penalties, for example. We don't know exactly what the end result could be.
Yeah, no, at this point, no. She just announced the intention to do this earlier this week, but exactly, you know, the nuts and bolts of it is to be determined.
We're talking with Scott Wortman and Dan Horn from the Cincinnati Inquirer here on Cincinnati Edition's weekly news review. And Dan, amid all of these protests, we have the coronavirus pandemic looming, and the pandemic shut down many things. It's the reason that we still have to be talking on the phone rather than having you guys in the studio like usual. And one area that was closed, of course, was eviction court in Hamilton County, but they're back open again after a landlord sued. Can you give us the story here?
Yeah, the courts will reopen on Monday. They had been closed for about 2.5 months because of the pandemic, along with a lot of other courts around the state and in Hamilton County. Hamilton County was one of the last counties in the state to announce reopening of the court. The judges, there was some confusion about this because early in the week, the judges had said they intended to continue to keep the court closed until July 1st, barring a change in the situation. A few days later, they were sued by a local landlord, and the landlord basically said that, you know, this is unconstitutional. It violates our property rights. We cannot, remove tenants who aren't paying rent. We cannot remove tenants who have violated their lease or committed crimes, and therefore it's violating our property rights. They filed that with the Ohio Supreme Court, and a day later, the judges reversed course and announced they would reopen on Monday. That then triggered an outburst from folks on the other end of this who are dealing, fair housing advocates and others who deal with folks who are getting evicted, and said, they had just received notices saying you don't have to come to court, and now suddenly they've got to go back to court, and there was no time to get those notices out. So there's in the short term, yesterday they reached an understanding where if you show up at court on Monday and both sides are not present, they will continue the case. And that is not typically how it works. If a landlord comes and a tenant doesn't, they can just go forward and with the eviction. But supposedly, we'll see how it works on Monday, that won't happen next week at least because of the short notice.
So you will need both parties to be present.
That's what I've been told. We'll see how it plays out on Monday. A lot of this was happening on the fly late yesterday, and so that was the last thing I had heard about how they're going to try to handle this. I know folks at Legal Aid were very concerned about tenants just not knowing they had a case at all, and then you just see eviction after eviction getting rubber stamped by a judge. So that apparently won't happen in that fashion. But whether it does or not, there's at least 1,000 pending cases now in eviction court because they've been on hold for so long. And Cincinnati in particular has always had a high eviction rate. It's about double the national average. There's about 4,500 evictions in Cincinnati a year. It has a high number of renters. So this is a big issue in Cincinnati. About 62% of people in Cincinnati are renters. That's in the top 10 in the country in terms of large cities. And about half of those renters are considered burdened renters because they spend at least a third of their income on housing. So evictions and housing has always been a big issue here, but particularly rental housing. So whatever happens in eviction court is going to have a big impact here and possibly a bigger impact in Cincinnati than in a lot of other cities.
Well, we'll take a look at what happens on Monday. So appreciative of both of your reporting, and we'll follow what comes of this weekend and in the days ahead. Dan Hoare and Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks to both of you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Michael.
And some local activists want to revisit the agreement reached in Cincinnati after a deadly police shooting and riots 19 years ago. And one local religious leader has some words for the president's recent photo op in front of a church near the White House. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher, who's on the phone with us. James, hello.
Hi, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing well. So glad to have you back on the program. Listen, a lot of things going on around town this week as it relates to protests and such. And we are revisiting something that emerged from a prior period of unrest in this city, and that's known as the collaborative agreement between the Cincinnati Police Department, the city, and organizations and other agencies. Some activists are looking for a refresh on this. Can you tell us a little bit about what's next?
Yeah, so in 2001, just as a background, after the Roger Owensby and Timothy Thomas deaths, there was obviously the racial unrest. So the city, it also sparked an U.S. Department of Justice investigation into the police practices at the Cincinnati Police Department. So at the end of the day, the judge overseeing that ordered them all to sit down at the table, as federal judge Susan DeLotte. They all sat down and came up with what's called a consent decree. And they said, we're going to agree to all this stuff. And one of those was called the collaborative agreement, which is when the community would work with the police on police reforms. So it was formalized and codified, but it had an expiration date of 2009. A lot of things came out of that. And they one of the biggest ones was something called the Citizens Complaint Authority, which was a separate independent arm of the city that could investigate any allegations of police wrongdoing, excessive uses of force, and they were called in any time the police had a fatal incident. So they would review it and think, okay, here's another independent eye on what this police might say happened. So, like I said, that all expired, but the CCA, as it's known, has kept in its various forms throughout the years. The biggest issue with the protesters when it comes to the CCA is that it has the amount of funding that the city has provided has been scaled back throughout the years. They did add an investigator, an extra investigator last year, but they're still not fully staffed to where they need to be. So they're behind. So they don't have enough staff to keep up with the complaints and all, and to investigate everything. The other complaint with the complaint authority is that it tends to rubber stamp whatever the police say. Now, I'm not saying that that is the case, but that has been the perception or the accusation. Now, the police and the city, on the other hand, have said, we've continued to reform things. We've, you know, gone to community policing. We've gone to de-escalation. We have gone to body cams before anybody else has. We stopped using, batons, and we use tasers more than guns. All of those things are true, and it's funny because I use my use of force data to when I teach journalism at the University of Kentucky. So I compiled use of force data for most of the first part of this decade, and you can see the amount of use of force and the amount of use of tasers spiked that first year when they had them, but progressively got less and less because the police started to learn how to use them. And the suspects, if you will, learned what they were all about and learned that you don't want to get tased. So there was a bit of that to it. So they wanted to reformalize all of this. All of the parties sat down at the table 2016, 2017, into 2018. Those talks fell apart. One of the reasons was one of the original people at the table, her name is Iris Rowley. She's very involved in the Black United Front. She was actually one of the co-signers, and she's been on the advisory panel all along for this agreement. She said some things about how there have been people murdered at the hands of the police. At the time, the then union president, he's still union president of the Cincinnati Police Union, Dan Hills, took issue with that. And so the police union backed out of those talks. So the entire talks kind of fell apart. I actually talked to the outside mediator the city hired, the consultant. He's a former U.S. attorney. He's a former vice mayor of Detroit. And he said, look, nobody was talking to each other. There was so much anger at that table. They just were not talking to each other. So that's kind of why it all fell apart. Now, the mayor clearly states, and he was emphatic on an interview with me earlier this week, that the city has continued to try to adhere to the collaborative. They believe in the collaborative, and they still, you know, and he even issued a letter yesterday saying to the protesters, I hear you, I'm willing to sit down and talk with you. So that's kind of where things stand. I probably talked for way too long, but I hope I kind of brought it all up into a bow.
James, not to diminish the reporting or the seriousness of the story, we always budget extra time for you, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I've been known to write long.
That's okay. We do appreciate the analysis and the reporting, but I mean, this conflict between the activists like Iris Rowley, who you mentioned, and the police union president, that's kind of ongoing, right? There's still friction there.
Oh, absolutely. I interviewed Dan Hills earlier this week, and he said, look, if I have some reasonable people at the table, I'm willing to come back to the table. And I said, does that mean Iris Rowley can't be there? And he said, I'm not going to go there, but I need some people that aren't just going to say the same old things. Iris Rowley, on the other hand, says, I'm not worried about Dan Hills. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. We're going to push for these reforms. Yeah, so there is bad blood there, and I don't know where it goes from here.
Well, we saw a letter from Mayor Cranley this week who responded to the list of recommendations that are coming from Iris Rowley and some other local activists like the Ohio Justice Policy Center, the Black United Front. Mm-hmm. The mayor says that he wants to sit down and talk with these folks, and he also mm-hmm. wants to bring in some of the younger people who are emerging from the current protest.
Yes. Yes, and I don't know some of the names involved with that. The protests were kind of one thing that I noticed was that there was it was a very ad hoc situation that, you know, some people didn't know where they were going from one minute to the next, and it was kind of all organized informally. I think they've gotten some more structure around it. One of the reasons they did that and they kept things off social media is because they were wary of what they called the outside agitators. and that they didn't want people from the outside coming in and getting violent when they didn't want to get violent. And we saw some of that Sunday. And I will say, I saw some of that because, you know, this was after I listened to Cranley's press conference. He was talking about how most of the people who were committing the violence from his point of view were white, maybe from the outside or taking advantage. And I said, oh, then I went out and I actually saw a young white male pretending to light a Molotov cocktail. And he was just kind of futzing around with it, but I saw it. I clearly saw it. So what Cranley said, I saw in person. So, you know, the protesters were like, especially on Monday, they were like, we're not going to put this stuff out there because we wanted to keep it to the message and we don't want these outside interests involved. But you're right. I mean, Cranley does want, I mean, in his letter, he clearly wants to be reaching out to the people who are also very passionate right now.
And we're talking with James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. James, before we let you go, we've got about a minute left. I want to talk about some other area that you covered. And that's something that I'm sure a lot of parents are looking forward to after a rough few months of dealing with the pandemic and also becoming teachers at home. And Ohio schools are starting to work on their reopening plans.
That is right. And count myself in that group. I've got a kid who's going to be in eighth grade next year, and this last semester was kind of rough. So, yeah, I mean, CPS put out its tentative ideas for a plan, and they're asking for feedback on it. All I can say is that it's a Gordian knot for a lot of these school systems who are already dealing with fewer resources and finances. How do you get the kids to school with less buses than you might have had, and yet you have to keep social distancing on a bus? You have to keep kids 6 feet apart in the classroom while you're already limited on space and the number of teachers you might have. You got to feed kids in the classroom and not a cafeteria. How do you manage that? Plus, there are going to be teachers and parents and students who do not still want to come to school, so you still have to provide them with the online option. So those are all of the many different variables that all these superintendents are dealing with. And at the same time, Kentucky hasn't even announced if and when they're going to open their schools. So that's a whole nother level of that, you know, and I think Beshear's administration told me they're waiting to see how the reopening of the businesses go before they announce anything for the schools.
James Pilcher is a reporter for WKRC-TV. Thanks for coming on, and we'll wish you the best for next semester so that you're not teaching again at home. But if you are, good luck with that.
Hey, Michael, great to be on. Thanks for having me again.
Our pleasure. President Trump posed in front of a church near the White House holding a Bible in the air, a move that was preceded by what some witnesses characterize as violent removal of protesters first. And one local bishop had some words about that event. And WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson is on the phone with us now. Howard, how are you?
Good, Michael. How are you?
This bishop did have some words. Tell us what those words were.
Yeah, the Bishop Bridenthal of the Southern Ohio Diocese of the Episcopal Church, I called him up just to see what he thought, and because obviously the Bishop of Washington, D.C. was furious about this, a political stunt that was put forward out in front of one of her churches and accomplished by police and military types forcibly removing a peaceful demonstration from in front of that church so that Trump could walk to it and stand there and hold a Bible in the air and have his picture taken. And Bishop Bridenthal, you know, just said, look, this is beyond the pale. He said, I try not to get involved in partisan political matters for the most part, but this crosses the line because he was using the text, the sacred text of our church and the physical location of our church, which had been attacked by some people who had set a fire in the church the day before, using our church as a political prop, a prop for his reelection campaign. And it's wrong. It's you know, he could have stood there and he could have prayed, he could have opened the Bible, he could have read from the Bible, but he didn't. He held it up in the air, and when he was asked by reporters, whose Bible is this, he said, it's a Bible.
And again, we're talking about Reverend Thomas Bridenthal. I'm sorry, Bridenthal.
Bridenthal, yeah.
The Episcopal bishop in Southern Ohio. And I want to share some of the quotes that you got from the bishop. And he was so very strong in the words. He says that the church was exploited, an exploitation of our church. And he says, and more importantly, an exploitation of our sacred text, and it was a sign of disrespect to the brown and black people in our country. I don't know that there is anything he could say except to apologize. Howard, Donald Trump is not known for apologizing.
No, he doesn't apologize, and he never will. This whole thing was cooked up as a stunt, and the Attorney General of the United States, Barr, was put in charge of clearing out those protesters who were peaceful, who were not causing any trouble on Lafayette Square. But he was going to push them back at least one block to get them away from the church so that they wouldn't get into Trump's photo opportunity, and did so very violently with pepper gas and flashbangs. And I mean, it was awful. What they did to get these folks out of the way. And there was no point in it. There was no reason for it. There was nothing happening there that would cause law enforcement to be concerned, except the fact that they were there, peaceably demonstrating and exercising their First Amendment rights.
And this photo op was condemned by the bishop in Washington, D.C. as well.
Oh, yes. She condemned it very strongly immediately. She was on the cable news networks talking about it, and was, as she said, she was just furious. She was very, very angry because no one in the White House or in the Secret Service had called ahead to the Episcopal diocese or to the church and told them that they'd like to come. And so they had no idea that this was going to happen.
And Howard, this had been described by some people, probably critics of the president, that this was his response to some of the criticism he was facing because his protests were raging in D.C., that he was reportedly in the bunker, the White House bunker, and he doesn't like to be seen as weak, so he planned this.
Right. Yes. I think that was what it was a response to, that, you know, because he's been changing the story about the bunker every few hours, ever since, he keeps insisting that he wasn't taken there by the Secret Service, that he was there inspecting it, as he said, 2.5 times. One thing you have to remember about this church, St. John's Episcopal, it's within sight of the White House. It's known as the Church of Presidents. Every president since James Madison has worshipped there at one point or another. Even Trump has been in a few times during his presidency. It's a historic institution and obviously a religious institution and one of the most important in the nation, really. And it should not be used as a political prop in a re-election campaign for anybody.
Howard Wilkinson is WVXU's senior political analyst. Great to have you on, especially when I know you've got a belly full of pancakes because one of your favorite diners reopened to the public today. So good on you for that.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for being with us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of our show is Selena Reeder. Our technical director today is Rick Andress. Archives are online at WVXU.org. And I'm Michael Monks.